Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Vic. You'll hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Vic claim to be the net coordinators for the technical net. This is the 29th year of the technical net. September of 1982 is when it all got started. And this net tonight will be net number 1,369 of the series that where these guys meet most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject. It doesn't have to be always technical. Even though it's called the technical net, a person who asks a so-called simple question, also gets the same amount of emphasis as a person who asks a complicated question. And when it comes to complicated questions, there are people who listen to the technical net and say, gee, I don't understand what you guys are talking about. And new material, when you're first exposed to it, let me drop it. When you're first exposed to new material, it's going to make you feel uncomfortable, something you haven't heard before. You have to hear it a number of times, hear people express it in various ways, various vocabulary, from the left, from the right, from the top, from the bottom, and eventually it starts making some sense. But new material is always uncomfortable. As they told me in the college that I went to, if you're feeling frustrated, if you're feeling uncomfortable, that's usually good. It means you're learning something. If you're sitting there and you understand exactly what's going on, you feel comfortable, most likely you're hearing material that for the third time that you've already heard before, and you're not learning anything in some cases. So uncomfortable is good. You've got to look at it the right way. Last week, in the late portions of the net, Glenn and I, KC2QIQ, got into a fairly heated discussion on how capacitors get charged in a switch mode type power supply, with resistors or with inductors. And those who listen to that tirade, on my part, could easily come to the conclusion these two guys are arguing with each other and trying to prove, who's got the high ground, so to speak. What's really going on is that the method by which certain kinds of material is taught in our colleges could be done better, and there's multiple ways of looking at it. Glenn and I were both seeking a higher truth. We weren't angry at each other. You play back those portions of the tape, and if you know what you're listening to, it's two people looking for the truth, even though each of us felt pretty strong passion for the way we were expressing what we were expressing. Another discussion I've heard a little bit during the week is on the very basic function of how an antenna works. If I asked, 10 real good experienced ham radio operators, does their 80-meter dipole need a good ground? Does it need a good counterpoise to work correctly and not create television interference? At least 80% of those guys would say, absolutely. It's got to have a good ground. It's got to have a good counterpoise, or you're not going to get good performance, and you're not going to get low television interference. There's more to that story. Also, we might possibly get into the high-voltage experiment that Wesley was talking about last week, where a Wimshurst machine, one of these high-voltage generating machines, was used in two different ways. And one of the ways that good common sense would dictate you should have less efficiency, it had more efficiency. I think I know an explanation for what's going on there. So lots of things will be discussed. The main subjects we discussed on the TechNet, particularly during the first hour, are the subjects that you bring as questions. Once in a while, we've got planned subjects, and you've heard a couple of things that I just planned that will be discussed later on. Also, one other thing, after we have check-ins tonight, because for two solid weeks we've been skipping the mailbag, if Mel is available, we're going to move that up. I'll move it a little bit earlier during the first hour. We'll go to the mailbag. But usually the first hour, those who check in the beginning of the first hour, we try to make a promise that they usually will get an answer during the first hour. Beyond that, all hell breaks loose. We discuss cabbages and kings, and sometimes it goes pretty far afield. If you don't want to listen to that kind of material, know ahead of time that that's going to take place. You've got 800 channels on that rig on 2 meters. You don't have to listen to this particular one, if you know what I mean. To be forewarned is to be forewarned. You know something about what's going to take place during the next few hours of this particular technical net. Let me drop. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, try to remember that because I'm so darn forgetful, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in to tell us you're listening. After 29 years we sort of believe that the people in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, somebody must be listening, or this technical net wouldn't have lasted for 29 years. There's obviously a thirst for knowledge on technical subjects, electronics in general, wireless electronics in particular. And from my point of view, the schools could be doing it a hell of a lot better than they do. They keep doing the same traditional thing over and over again. And you ask each electronic engineer which course did he have the most amount of trouble with. Usually, the majority of guys will answer the fields and waves course, the electromagnetic theory course, the Maxwell's equations course. The way that's taught in our colleges could definitely be more relevant to the real world. The tradition of that particular course was set in 1947, and it hasn't changed since. You take a good computer science course, and the material is changing every single semester. Both subjects are equally as valuable. In fact, I could say that the wireless engineering course is more valuable because there are 20 kinds of wireless products being used by the American public today. Those 20 products are continuously evolving, developing, changing, improving, and yet the method by which we teach that material to our students has not changed in 40 or 50 years. Something's wrong there. Somebody's got to grab that particular bull by the horns and say, if we keep doing the same thing, if we keep doing the same thing and expect a different answer, it's not rational. You'll still have students that say, I don't understand that course. I can't apply that material. There's got to be a better way. That's a bunch of opinions. Okay, let me take check-ins right now. Give me your call letters, your name, and that word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick, and we're listening.
KC2WGB, yes. Question on the Scopes trial of last week.
KC2RSN, yes.
Okay, Alan is number two. Alan was that mystery voice, who didn't give us his name. He happened to be the guy that nominated the technical net for the award, the national award that it got last year. Okay, we got John and that mysterious guy, Alan. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and that word yes right now.
N2XZ, and I don't know if you want to take it now. It's a basic question. Because of the statement, there is no and never has been an antenna that doesn't have a counterpoise, the vector of physics does not allow that. Back to you.
Okay. I think that will be our third question. The basics of how an antenna works, from my point of view, is a very valid subject. So we've got John, Alan, and Wesley in that order. Who else? Give me your call letters, name, and the word yes right now. Okay. Now let's see if Mel is available. K2KEY, are you aboard, Mel? K2RIW in the TechNet. And maybe Mel has not become available yet. Okay, our first questioner was John, KC2WGB. Go right ahead, John. And Glenn and I have had some more emails back and forth to each other. We kept them secret. We said, make sure you don't tell John what we discovered here. That's a joke. And we think we understand how a capacitor gets charged. That was this heated discussion that went on for 45 minutes, starting close to midnight last week. And when you play back those tapes, in fact, what was unique about that particular set of recordings is that the website that gives you the information, which is www.amateurradio.tangovictor, you go to that particular website and you can play back all of the previous websites, the previous TechNet, and KC2NJI, Mike Perry, does all that work. Normally, he doesn't get a chance to put that material on the website until about Wednesday. The Sunday material appears usually the next Wednesday or so. That particular one appears on Monday. So starting on Monday, you could have heard that particular one. So what about that discussion gave you questions, John? That's almost a joke. KC2WGB, the microwave voice of Staten Island, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Okay, KC2WGB. Good evening, everyone on the net. My question is, the original topic was charging the capacitor. Glenn claimed that it could only be up to 50% or less, and we never got a resolution of that. That's what I wanted to know, whether Clarence Darrow won or William Jennings. So how did it go? What was the final solution?
Well, also, if you could go back to the point, which was interesting. At one particular point, and the sinus signal, sinusoidal signal, the capacitor, all of the energy is in the coil, and the other half of that shape is in the capacitor, if you could relate to that.
Yeah, for those who haven't heard the discussion from roughly midnight last week, this all got started on one of the very basic things that's taught in your sophomore course in electronic circuits, if you're taking an electrical engineering course in almost any of the good schools in the United States, schools of higher learning. You're getting your bachelor degree or something close to it, and they teach you how inductors, capacitors, and resistors work and what happens when you put them together in various combinations. And about halfway through that course, they give you a really tough little puzzle, simple looking, very deceptive. I've got two capacitors that are identical sitting on the bench. Each one of them was, let me pick a number, 1 microfarad of capacitance. One of them is charged to 10 volts. The other one is uncharged. These are ideal capacitors. And so you pick up these two capacitors with only 10 volts on one. You can touch it with your fingers if you wanted to, and it wouldn't create any damage. So you take the 10-volt charged capacitor and the uncharged capacitor, and you simply connect them together. You'll get a spark, and when the smoke settles, so to speak, you put your voltmeter there, and you find out that the 10 volts that was on the first capacitor now gets shared between the two capacitors, and you get 5 volts total. Charge has been preserved, Q equals CV. In other words, the amount of charge in coulombs, Q, is the usual letter used for that, is the product of the capacitance and the voltage. Well, you started off with 1 microfarad and 10 volts. You end up with the two capacitors in parallel. That's 2 microfarads and 5 volts. 10 times 1 or 5 times 2 is the exact same amount of charge. So charge was preserved. Now there's an energy equation. The energy equation tells you that the amount of energy in a capacitor is 1/2 CV squared. 1/2 times the capacitance in farads times the voltage in volts, and you square the
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So the voltage is going to become squared. You started off with 10 volts. You square that, you get 100. You multiply that by the 1 microfarad. Let me make it 1 farad just to round off the numbers. And then you take 1/2 of the result. So you get 50 joules of stored energy with 10 volts on a 1 farad capacitor. When you take the two capacitors together with 5 volts, now you use the 1/2 CV squared again. 5 volts squared is 25. Multiply times the capacitance 2, you get 50. Did I do that right? 25, yes. 25, you get 50. And then you take half of that result, you come back to 25. So you started off with 50 joules of stored energy when all the voltage was on one capacitor. You put the two together, you wait until it settled, and now you've got 25 joules. You've got half the amount of energy. So the charge was preserved. The voltage did something rational. You came down to half voltage for twice the capacitance. That makes some sense. Your common sense would think you shared the energy, but since true energy storage in a capacitor is voltage squared, half the voltage is 1/4 of the energy if you weren't changing the capacitance, and you can sort of see mathematically you've lost 50% of the energy when you put those two together. In that sophomore class or your junior class, when you get that particular puzzle, my goodness, life gets complicated. You suddenly realize that Mother Nature has done something kind of capricious. What in the world is going on here? Well, you know that a large amount of current flowed because one of the universal laws of capacitance is that you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. You want to change the voltage on the capacitor, it's going to take you some amount of time to do it if you're doing it with a finite amount of current. You can't instantaneously change the voltage.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So as I said to repeat, you can't instantaneously change the voltage on the capacitor, yet when you put the two together, assuming they were ideal capacitors, assume they had no real significant series resistance anywhere, you got great big fat leads, very well-made capacitors, and you put the two together. One of them had 10, one of them had 0, they're going to both end up at 5. So The 0 jumped up to 5, the 10 jumped down to 5, the 10 jumped down to 5. There was an apparent instantaneous change in voltage as far as normal instrumentation connected to those capacitors during the event when you put them together. What's really going on is that the first capacitor being charged, since you cannot instantaneously change the voltage, you could say it is an irresistible force. And the one that is uncharged, you could say you're trying to bring it from 0 to 5 volts instantaneously. It's an immovable object. These are the words of an old song back in the 40s, an irresistible force and an immovable object. And that's what you've done. You put the two together, and the words of the song says something has to give. Well, in the real world, every real capacitor has got some number of milliohms of resistance of its leads. Internally, it's got some number of real ohms of equivalent series resistance. So there's some real resistance going on here. And at the instant you put them together, the calculated current is infinity, or something very, very large. It's an impulse. You can talk about the total charge that was transferred, the amount of area under the curve, so to speak, of charge transfer, but you can't talk about the instantaneous current. You're dividing by 0 ohms, and you got the 10 volts, so to speak, or a 5 volts. Yeah, 10 volts. You got a 10 volt difference at the instant you first put them together, and you've got, in a simple diagram on the page, you think you got 0 ohms, and you divide 0 into 10, and the current that flows must be infinity. In reality, what really happens? The equivalent series resistance is the biggest explanation. Let me drop. Also, you know for a fact that if you put a clamp-on ammeter across either one of the leads of either one of the capacitors, at the instant you connect them together, no matter what you use for a clamp-on ammeter, a clamp-on scope probe, for instance, you will saturate that device. The total current that flows is thousands of amperes. You're going to saturate any reasonable current measuring device that doesn't work by a series resistance being installed. But when you have an extremely large current flowing like that, the Lenz's law or Faraday's law dictates that the current creates a strong magnetic field. That magnetic field is really a radio impulse, and so even if you had ideal capacitors that had no real equivalent series resistance anywhere, and you can come pretty close to that if you're willing to build something very big with very stoochy materials, still you're going to get a nearly infinite current. That infinite current is making a very, very strong, nearly infinite magnetic field. That magnetic field is a radio wave that gets transmitted into space. Energy leaves that circuit. 50% of energy loss, a significant portion of it is radiated into space. It goes out in all directions, and you could, without great heroic effort, you couldn't recapture it, if you know what I mean. It's a very educational process. Now, when it comes to a switch mode power supply, in the case of a switch mode power supply, you're not taking two capacitors and put them across each other. You've got some kind of a switching transistor in there, and you command the transistor to go from the open circuit to the closed circuit. So the transistor, if you've got a big enough, really smart, a very large field effect transistor, you could create a 0 to infinity impedance, so to speak. You could switch it from the non-conducting mode to the conducting mode, and it's capable of transmitting tremendous amounts of current. So even though you're doing it electronically, you could have a very similar situation. If you're now smart enough to put a real inductor between the two, you just take a very high quality, let me pick a number, 1 millihenry or 1 henry inductor, and now you don't charge, you don't connect the capacitors directly, you connect them through the inductor. There's something magic about the way an inductor and a capacitor complement each other. If you put an AC current through a capacitor, if you put an AC voltage through a capacitor, the current will lead. You put an AC voltage through an inductor, the current will lag. Inductor and capacitor put across each other, one leads in current versus voltage, one lags. They complement each other. You and I call it a resonator. So if there was a finite amount of real inductance between the two, on the very first cycle after you connected them, anywhere during that cycle, you can calculate the amount of energy in the capacitor, the amount of energy in the inductor, the amount of energy in the other capacitor, and you'll realize that for a significant period of time, there is no energy loss when you do it with a real inductor. So switch mode power supplies, if they're well designed, charge the capacitors with inductors, So getting back to the original question that Glenn and I were really discussing with all kinds of heated emotion last midnight at Sunday night, was in the case of a ideal inductor
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
If I simply start off with a charge capacitor and I put an inductor across it, or vice versa, I charge the inductor by putting current across it at some number of amperes, and then I connect it across the capacitor and let go. Whenever you put an inductor and a capacitor across each other, it is a resonator. It follows a very simple formula. It follows a very well-established formula. The frequency of resonance, the frequency of operation, is 1 over 2 pi times the square root of LC, inductor and capacitor. You multiply the inductor in Henry times the capacitor in farads, take the square root, multiply that by 2 pi, divide all of that into 1, that is your operating frequency. And what's really going on in that operating frequency? After the couple of emails that Glenn and I mailed back and forth to each other, we think we finally settled it. And that is, if I started off with a charged inductor, 1 Henry inductor to make it simple, 1 ampere I was putting through the inductor for a long period of time, so now I've established a magnetic field inside that inductor by me putting 1 ampere through it for a long period of time, and it settled down. It was steady state, 1 ampere, and it's a very good inductor, very little resistance, almost no voltage drop across it when you're doing that. And I've got this uncharged 1 farad capacitor. And I suddenly disconnect the power supply that was charging the inductor. Instantaneously, I put it across that 1 farad capacitor, and I let go, and I watch what happens. What happens? A 1 farad capacitor and a 1 Henry inductor will have a resonant frequency by that formula of 1 over 6.28. It's 0.157 hertz, 6.28 seconds per cycle. That's a very low frequency. Well, that's because a 1 farad capacitor is a very big capacitor. A 1 Henry inductor is a pretty big inductor. You put the two together, and you'll have a beautiful sine wave between the two. You put your oscilloscope there, and you watch this very slow, very...
Repeater, timeout, repeater.
WH4YY, late check-in. I'd like to be put on the list of questionnaires.
You're there, Joe. Let me wait for the beep. So you'll watch this very slow sine wave, which takes 6.28 seconds for one single cycle to take place. And during that cycle, the energy flows back and forth 4 times. It's really kind of magic. At the instant you take the 1 ampere charged inductor and you connect it instantaneously across the uncharged 1 farad capacitor, at that instant there's 0 volts on the capacitor. Under normal circumstances, you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. So that voltage will very slowly rise. It takes 1.5 seconds to go from 0 volts up to 1 volt. At that instant of time. By the way, when you first connected it, all the energy of 1 ampere flowing into the 1 Henry inductor, you go through the calculation, joules in the inductor is 1/2 LI squared, inductance in Henry times current squared, 1 ampere squared is 1, 1 Henry, you multiply it together and multiply the whole thing by half. You had half a joule of energy. By the way, a joule is a watt second. It's also a Newton meter. You apply a force to something of 1 Newton, where the force, which is, I think it's something like 0.2 pounds, and you move that device through 1 meter of length, you're sliding a block on a table, so to speak, it takes 1 newton of force to do it, and you slide the block 1 meter, you've exerted 1 watt second or 1 joule of energy in doing that. So a joule is a Newton meter, or it's 1 watt of energy flowing for 1 second. So 1/2 joule is in the inductor at the instant you connect it to the capacitor. Because the capacitor cannot instantaneously change its voltage, because you cannot instantaneously change the current flowing through an inductor, that's another one of the rules, the two are very compatible devices. The 1 ampere continues to flow for a while, but slowly decreases as the voltage on the capacitor increases. 1.5 seconds later, the voltage on the capacitor hits maximum. It's the top of the sine wave. It's plus 1 volt is on the capacitor. The slope of that sine wave has now gone to zero up at the peak of that slope of the sine wave. And since the slope is zero, you know that the current flowing at that instant is zero. That means that there is no energy left in the inductor. The current has gone to zero, obvious by the slope of the top of the sine wave has gone to zero. You've got 1 volt on the capacitor, you've got zero current in the inductor, 1/2 Li², you've got 1/2 a joule of energy, every bit of it is in the capacitor. So in 1/4 of a cycle, all the energy started off in the inductor, 1/4 of a cycle later, 1.57 seconds later, all the energy is in the capacitor. Then the process reverses. Now the capacitor voltage starts discharging into the inductor, and it starts going through zero the second time on the way down. And so at the instant it goes through zero, you've now got an ampere flowing from the capacitor toward the inductor. The voltage on the inductor, on the capacitor, is about to go through zero. So the stored energy in the capacitor is going to go to zero for the second time, and all the energy is in the inductor for the second time. And that's just half a cycle. I've gone through 1/4 of a cycle on the way up, 1/4 of a cycle on the way down, and now we're going to go to the negative voltages. So in the case of a resonating circuit, the stored energy in the inductor, the stored energy in the capacitor, trade back and forth, essentially losslessly, 4 times. Kind of a made
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And this particular method of analyzing that circuit, every parallel resonator, every series resonator you've ever used is doing this. If I used quality enough capacitors, I could have a ring down. In other words, I start the circuit, connect the two together. If the components are low enough in loss, I connect my oscilloscope across there and I watch it. The circuit could easily go for 1,000 cycles of slowly decaying sine wave. It would take 1,000 cycles to ring down to 1/2 or 10% of the original voltage, so to speak. And if it's got 1,000 cycles of ring down, because the circuit's got a Q of 1,000 in my particular example, and I'm only analyzing the very first cycle, and so on that very first cycle, very little of the energy is lost. 99% of the energy is there between the beginning of that cycle and the end of the cycle. And I'm talking about each quarter of the cycle, the voltage rising, the voltage coming back down, and so on. I'm a little bit unhappy about the fact that most of the schools do not teach a resonating circuit in that manner.
I have a little unclear in here.
So I know it can be done better, but to answer John's original question, to my knowledge, after the emails that flowed back and forth between me and Glenn, and if Glenn's possible on the frequency, he's allowed to say, no, I disagree, and that's perfectly all right, because we're seeking truth here. We're not trying to find out who's got the biggest gun, if you know what I mean, or who's got the tallest mountain or the tallest tower or whatever. We're seeking truth. We think we've got a better goal than all that. And I think we've settled on what takes place. Let's see if Glenn is available. KC2QIQ, if you're there, you're allowed to put in a few words on this one, Glenn, because we started a little bit of a controversy last week, K2RIW in the TechNet. Now, maybe Glenn is not there, but I wonder if it makes a little more sense to you, John. I know that the way we were hollering at each other, it sounded like we were hollering at each other. It wasn't super clear what was the final answer, but I think the answer was, when you charge a capacitor with a simple resistor network, I got a 10-volt battery, I got a 1-ohm resistor, I close the switch across the capacitor, and through the 1-ohm resistor, I charge the 1-farad capacitor with the 10-volt power supply, and if I calculate carefully the total amount of energy flowing out of the power supply, and what finally ends up on the capacitor as the capacitor comes up to 10 volts in that example, you'll find out that half the energy is lost in the resistor. The total amount of heat in the resistor, I'm going to end up with 0.5 joule of energy in the capacitor, or is it 5 joules? Let's see now. 10 volts, 100 divided by 1, is 50. Yeah, 50 joules. 50 joules of energy will end up in the capacitor, and the resistor will be dissipating 50 joules of energy. So whenever you charge a capacitor with a simple resistor network, and it could be a series pass transistor that's being used in the analog manner, when you charge a capacitor with a resistor-like network, you will suffer 50% energy loss. But if you're a smart enough engineer, on your switch mode power supply, that you use an intermediate inductor between the power supply and the capacitor you wish to charge. If you charge it with an inductor, you do it correctly. You can do it at very close to 100% efficiency. So from my point of view, all well-designed switched mode power supplies are charging their filter capacitors with inductors, not with a simple resistive network. You get into these kind of jazz of efficiencies and clarity of the signal coming out of a good power supply when you start studying rectifier power supply filter networks. And you can have a choke input type filter network or a simple capacitor input type filter network. And you'll find out that essentially all broadcast transmitters, because they have to pay the efficiency by way of their huge electric bill to Con Ed or to LIPA, because they're taking hundreds of thousands of watts of power to run their transmitter. You'll find out when you study their power supplies are almost all inductor input filter networks in order to run efficiently. They don't want to waste half of their money by burning up the heat in resistors when they charge the capacitors of their filter network and the power supply. I know that this is not the whole story, but maybe it helps a little bit, John. That's your original question. I wonder if it makes a little more sense now. And you're allowed to ask more questions if not. KC2WGB, the guy who asked the original K2LIW in the TechNet tonight. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, that answered my question. The only further question I have, now if we don't use a resistor or an inductor, now we have just the resistance of the power supply. So basically, the internal resistance of the power supply is going to give us a negative effect also, so we still would not be able to reach maximum transfer. Is that correct?
I think I'm going to agree with that one, John. Assume now that Con Ed, which is what's supplying power to Richmond County, Staten Island, where you live, Todd Hill area, that's where the smart people go. Normally you take your Con Ed power supply, 120 volts AC or 240 volts AC, and you're going to build some kind of a power supply out of it. Quite possibly you're going to use a step-down transformer to step down the 120 volts to, say, 12 volts RMS, which is something like 18 volts peak. You're going to go through some kind of a rectifier network, charging your capacitors, and you would desire 13.2 volts output from your power supply to run all the rigs in the shack. And now, if you're smart enough to use a big enough transformer that's doing a step down from 120 volts down to 12 volts RMS in my example, and if you choose a high enough quality transformer which has very little resistance in the primary winding, very little resistance in the secondary winding, a good set of EI laminations for the magnetic core of the transformer, and no saturation has taken place, you've done a good transformer design, you've gone into a good high quality bridge rectifier network, and now you want that power supply to charge your filter capacitors with a 13.2 volts output. At least in the beginning of the first time you turn it on, if between that bridge rectifier network and the capacitors there was a properly chosen swinging choke, as they used to call it in the old days, choke input type filter network, and if you're charging the capacitors with a choke, and then a good quality choke and a good quality capacitor, that total power supply, as I just described it, could easily run 98% efficiency. And if you did it with just a simple resistor in there, you could run a hell of a lot lower efficiency. But we're now discussing what happens with energy into your filter capacitor.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm talking about energy and the efficiency with which the energy you put into that filter capacitor the first time you turn it on. In reality, you wouldn't have to use quite so many high-quality components, because once the circuit has gone through the startup transient and the voltage on the capacitor is nearly a constant 3.2 volts, then you've got a few more options. But as you can see, that charging of the first turn-on of that power supply with the components I just described, with a good design, you could approach 98% efficiency. So knowing that there's something very compatible about inductors as a method of charging a capacitor from any kind of a power supply, whether it's a pulsating power supply from a full-wave rectifier or whether it's a battery source power supply, no matter what the source of energy is, If on the very first turn on you want efficiency and you do it by way of an inductor, in my opinion, you can approach 100% efficiency. I think that's what you're sort of asking, John, and it's more to the story, as you can tell. Power supplies, by the way, most engineers say, that's something that's not important. I want to do something much more exciting in my electrical engineering career. Some of the best work I have ever done, in my opinion, is to design very reliable power supplies that went onto the receivers and transmitters of the B-1B bomber aircraft. Because I suddenly realized, way back 20-some-odd years ago, let me drop, that you could have a gold-plated transmitter, a gold-plated receiver, very high quality of both, and if the power supply that feeds them fails, you're off the air. That beautiful transmitter, the beautiful receiver, will do you no good if the power supply fails. So if you put some real solid, high-reliability engineering into the power supply, even though it's considered non-glamorous work, in the big picture, when it comes to the total circuit being reliable, make sure the power supply works first. As I've told you guys many times, whenever you've got a failure of a piece of electronics that you own, and you're starting to do troubleshooting, and assuming that you've got the right equipment, and you know what you're doing, and you're not going to get in trouble, the very first time you open up the box to try to figure out what's wrong, the first thing you should do is measure every one of the power supply voltages right back at the source of the power supply. Are all the voltages correct before you proceed downrange? Whenever I've ignored that rule, my goodness, did I waste time. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the deck net.
Comment.
John first, then we'll go over to Wesley next. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, thank you for those comments. And you're right. Stick with the basics, and you'll never go wrong. I have a much clearer understanding now. But I was just wondering what the outcome was exactly. So now I have all the information. I guess Alan's next, but back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the exact waveforms of integrating the sine wave, or the derivative of the sine wave, which is integrating a cosine wave, as to how the current flows, you know, microsecond by microsecond between the inductor and the capacitor, how that really works. You can make the mathematics very complicated, and you can get yourself, at first, in a fair amount of trouble. But I know that Wesley wanted to make a comment on this one before we go to the next subject. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. What do we think of the capacitor, and then we attached another capacitor with a spark? My question is, we have a potential energy and we have a kinetic energy. And because in the short period of time we are not able to discharge the first capacitor that was charged before, then even though that we made a spark, when we can try to measure the current that we'll be able to get out of each one of the capacitors, even the voltage is half. My understanding is that the capacitor that was uncharged before will deliver lesser of the current in lesser of the time, or if it would be the same current, it would be in a shorter period of time, the capacitor was fully charged. That's the first part. The second one, we have a capacitor and a coil connected together in parallel, let's jump. Then, in a half of a cycle, we have energy in a capacitor. In another half of a cycle, we have energy in the coil. Okay. But then, the question is, what about potential energy? Because the capacitor is holding a potential energy, even though that kinetic energy is transferred. If you know what I'm saying. And to exam.
Okay, you're putting the vocabulary into mechanical engineering words, even though it's an electrical engineering subject. And in many cases, you can convert from one to the other, and if you know what you're doing, it helps illuminate what's really going on. What you're calling kinetic energy is really what an electrical engineer calls the transient response. The potential energy from the mechanical engineering world is what an electronic engineer will call the stored energy, the steady state response. When you connected the charged capacitor across the uncharged capacitor, because the two You think you're putting them in parallel, but if I started off at one capacitor and I walk out of the top lead of the first capacitor, I walk across the lead to the second capacitor, I walk through the second capacitor, I walk down the second lead of the second capacitor, back to the bottom lead of the first capacitor, from one point of view, you think you put the two in parallel. It really is, simplistically, a series network. By definition, a series network, whatever current flows in any one part of the network, if it's one simple series path, the current that flows in any one part of the circuit has to be identical to the other current. So the current flowing out of capacitor number one and the current flowing into capacitor number two must be the identical current. And yes, when you study what happens between the beginning and the end of this event, half of the total stored energy is going to be lost. Some of that energy is lost in the form of the spark, which really is a kind of an arc, a plasma, transmitting light and heat and energy into space, magnetic field, the equivalent series resistance between the two components, and so on. The total energy that flows from the first capacitor to the second capacitor, darn close to 50% of it is going to be lost. In reality, there's going to be a little bit of an inductance between the two, and so if, had you put a real inductor there, you would find that you've changed the resonant frequency you've established a really clearly defined resonant frequency, and it's going to ring down, and now you're talking about the first cycle. By the way, you've used one other set of words, Wesley, and I want to make sure that people don't remember it exactly that way, which could be an error. Let me drop. It's very easy to say that you start off with the 1 ampere flowing in the inductor, you instantaneously connect it across the uncharged capacitor, and now energy is going to trade back and forth between the two, and it's easy to say the energy trades back and forth each half cycle. It's each quarter cycle. From the 0 degree point to the 90 degree point on the 0 to 360 degrees for the cycle, during the 0 to 90 degrees, all the energy per se flows from the inductor into the capacitor, and now you've got peak voltage on the capacitor, 1 volt in my example. During the next quarter cycle, between 90 degrees and 180 degrees, all the energy that's in the capacitor will become current flowing through the inductor, magnetic field. That's only half a cycle, and I've traded the energy twice, from inductor to capacitor, from capacitor back to inductor.
Yeah, but the energy in joules is still stored in the capacitor. My question was that if you have two capacitors at first and you make a spark, the amount of energy in the first charge capacitor is supposed to be bigger because you cannot instantaneously unload. So but then when you connect the load to each one after you made the spark, you see that the capacitor that was non-charged holds for the shorter period of time the same current as the one that was charged before.
Your wording makes it sound like you think that only the capacitor can store energy.
No. What I was saying is you have two charged capacitors right now after the spark. Now you're trying to measure the current over the time from each one separately. You see that the capacitor was charged before, because it was charged before for the longer period of time, holds the current longer than the one that was uncharged.
However, the two circuits are a parallel network or a series network. You can analyze it either way. Would you agree with me that there is no way that the current flowing from or to capacitor number one can be any different than the current flowing to or from capacitor number two?
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so the currents have to be the same. The rate of change of voltage.
Yeah, but the thing is that you have, after the spark, you have two separate capacitors. You measure the time that the uncharged capacitor is able to hold the current. When you try to, let's say, unload the current, unload the capacitor, uncharged, that time will be shorter than the capacitor was previously charged.
I think I disagree. And we're going to have to move on. We're going to come back to this during the more serious portion of the TechNet later on. I'm going to go on to question number two. Alan, KC2RFN, go right ahead. You're allowed to ask anything. except how to get rich quick. You got it, Alan. K2RIW in the tech net.
KC2RSN. Good evening, Dick. My question is a lot more general. I've been reading lately about the Apollo missions, and I've been watching some of the documentaries that they have on Netflix, and it brings up the question about their communications. And I know you have eavesdropped on them on at least one Apollo mission. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about that and what the involved frequencies were, modes, polarities, simplex, duplex. And do you know if when the LEM was on the moon, did they communicate directly back to Houston? What did they use the command module as a repeater? These sorts of things, Dick, I'm very curious about now. Back to you.
Yes, in the summer of 1971, Apollo 15 was on the way to the moon. I realized that having sent a letter to NASA, asked for frequencies, they mailed back a very nice frequency chart, knowing full well that they're using the 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, to listen to the astronauts, and they knew that there was only a 10-watt signal on board, and they're going to be a quarter of a million miles away. They knew that essentially nobody would be able to hear that, so they told me the frequencies. The downlink frequency for the command module of Apollo 15 and 16. I listened to Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. I listened to not only the command module, the lunar module, the ALSEP package frequency, and so on. They're all on what's called the unified S-band. The command service module of Apollo 15 and 16, all of the Apollos were on 2287.5 megacycles. 2287.5 megacycles was the carrier frequency. August 1972, QST Magazine, you can read the article by Paul Wade, W4HHK and K2RIW, describing the frequencies, the schematic diagram of how we did it, pictures and whatever. As I said, that was a crutch in July. A June or July issue was the article entitled Houston, This is Apollo. The August issue was the design of the dish. And in that same year, the February and March issue was the parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432 megacycles. So I think it's the June issue. Anyhow, Houston, This is Apollo is the name of the article. Let me drop. The command module sends a signal back to Earth and hopefully being picked up by the 240-foot dish. And the dish is used for when they're using the low-gain antenna, the omnidirectional antenna, which only has 0 dB of gain. The satellite could be in essentially any orientation, and the 240-foot dish in California can easily pick that up. And by the way, there's one in Spain, and there's one in Australia. So as the Earth turns, there's always one of those three main dishes always aimed at the Apollo spacecraft on the way to the moon and while it's going around the moon and so on. 2287.5 megacycles, 10 watts of transmit power, circular polarized. Right-hand circular polarization was what's being transmitted. When they're on the Omni antenna, with a real good receiver, I could hear the carrier as a weak tone in the noise, but it wasn't strong enough to get audio out of it. But they spent 95% of their time on the high-gain antenna, a dish antenna on the side of the command module, which was gimbaled, and it's always aimed at Earth. And while they're using the high-gain antenna, I'm listening to this beautiful signal. What was it now? A millionth of a billionth of a watt is what I'm getting. I'm picking it up with a 12-foot diameter dish, 36 dB of gain, a parametric amplifier front end borrowed from AIL, went into a spectrum analyzer as a down converter, and the final receiver was an FM demodulator built into a Drake R4C receiver. It was a Drake 2B, I'm not sure which. Anyhow, the actual astronaut audio was not directly on that carrier. Let me drop. The carrier at 2287.5 megs was being phase modulated at two separate rates, 1.02 megacycles and 1.25 megacycles, or 1.5 megacycles, or was it 2.5 megacycles? Anyhow, the 2.5, or was the 1.5 megacycle subcarrier, is the one that contained astronaut audio. The other subcarrier contained biometric information, telemetry information, voltages, and whatever. I, of course, was listening to astronaut audio. And the right way to build a receiver, if you had the time, is to build a receiver that listens to the main carrier. Then it's got another separate IF strip that picks off the subcarrier, and then an FM demodulator on the subcarrier. I didn't have all that equipment. I reasoned that the method of modulation was creating an upper side lobe and a lower side lobe. I listened to only the upper side lobe, tuned to that frequency. If it was 2.5 megs, and I've forgotten, let's assume it was 2.5 megs, I tuned 2.5 megs off to one side, listened to that subcarrier, listened to the FM modulation of astronaut audio. The disadvantage of doing it that way is I threw away half the energy. I wasn't listening to the other side lobe. The advantage is that it was a much simpler circuit, and when they're on the high gain antenna, and I'm using my 12-foot diameter dish, and it's properly aimed, I was getting enough astronaut audio. I was about 2 or 3 dB above reasonable audio threshold. And I heard lots of astronaut audio during the times they were not connected to the networks, and therefore, at times I heard some reasonably candid information, which I think I've told you guys about from time to time. When they're using the lunar module, most of the time was transmitting a signal back to the command module, the lunar rover car.